owe them, but very few of us know them. They took an oath to protect us at home and abroad, so the rest of us can live safe and free. They are the men and women of our military and first responder communities, and these are their stories. American Warrior Radio is on the air.
Uba Tower, this is Cat Radio 1. I'm turning on the downwind, my prop is overrun. My engine's overheated, my chip detector's bright. So light up that old runway, cause I'm landing here tonight. Well, hello, Cat Killer 801. Now, this is Fubai Tower. I'd like to wake the crash crew up, but it is their coffee hour. The runway lights are broken and the generator's down. So, Cat Killer 801, take that bird around.
Welcome to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen, telling the stories of those who protect us on the home front and abroad. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. What you just heard was the last verse of the Cat Killers theme song written and performed by Captain Kenneth Trent. Now, we didn't play that to insult any of you pet-loving listeners out there, but rather in honor of the guest we have on American Warrior Radio today. Cat Killer was a call sign for the Army 220th Aviation Company, which flew over the skies of Vietnam. They flew light, slow, single-engine aircraft with virtually no armament other than the rifle, pistol, and the odd hand grenade that their crew members might have carried. You might think that's not very sexy in terms of fighter pilots, but to the Marines and other personnel on the ground, they were the angels on their shoulders, risking everything to save lives on the ground. Our guest today flew under the call sign Cat Killer 32. He's got a new book out appropriately titled Cat Killer 32, An Army Pilot Flying for the Marines in the Vietnam War. Raymond Carroll, welcome to American Warrior Radio.
Thanks, Ben.
Is it okay if I call you Ray?
Absolutely.
Okay, well, Ray, let's start with a little bit. Again, your book is Cat Killer 32. It just hit the shelves in September, right?
Yes, in September.
And folks can find this on Amazon or their local bookstore or wherever.
Barnes & Noble, Amazon, and Naval Institute Press. They want to go there and get it.
Well, I tell you, I really enjoyed this book. Let's talk a little bit about Ray himself. You, like many of your fellows at that point in our history, faced the choice of the draft or enlisting, and you chose the Army.
Yes, I did. I had kind of run out of options. I'd failed in college for a couple of years. The only thing I managed to pass was ROTC. And they sent me a letter, said, take your physical, and I did. And I thought, you know, I think I'd like to enlist so I can have some degree of control over what I do for 3 years other than just, you know, jump in for two. That's what I did, and once I got in, I discovered the gratification of short-term goal attainment, and I just kept going from there, and it got better and better.
Now, Ray, I got to tell you, I've read a lot of military books. I have yet to read one that actually used a quote from Matthew Perry, a Matthew Perry line from the movie, you are everything I never knew I always wanted, and you use that to cite your love of aircraft and flying.
Yeah. I didn't always. I had a fear of flying. My stepdad and I didn't get along, but he had several small airplanes. And he talked me into going up one day with one of his buddies who had been a World War II fighter pilot. So instead of kind of easing me into flying, he decided to do loops and rolls and spins. Scared the living daylights out of me, and I didn't go near any of my stepdad's airplanes after that. But after I got in the military and had an opportunity to go to Officer Kennedy School, and that's where I got interested in aviation. Do you want to know that story?
Well, let's talk a little bit, because I try to be a lifelong learner, and one of the things that really jumped out at me in starting your book, which I enjoyed very much, by the way, was the sort of dispute that was taking place between the Air Force and the Army at the time about who gets to fly. Who owns the fixed-wing aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that a very interesting historical take on what you were going through at the time. So long story short, how did that fall out?
Well, the Johnson-McConnell agreement, both of them were one with the chief of staff for the Air Force, one the chief of staff for the Army. The Army had been exploring the use of helicopters as the new way to carry troops into combat. And they started a unit at Fort Benning. It was called the 11th Air Assault. And they did all the testing for a couple of years. That concept really took hold, and the Army said, this is the direction we want to go. And they had Caribou, which was a smaller twin-engine cargo aircraft that they would use to transport material and bullets and stuff back and forth. And the Air Force kind of got the idea that the Army was wanting to start its own Air Force all over again. Remember, the Air Force was a spinoff from the Army Air Corps. And they didn't like that, and the Army wanted better control of what was going on. So in the end, the agreement was that the Air Force would take the Caribous. The Army was allowed to have armed helicopters, and then their larger Chinook CH-47 helicopters for carrying heavy loads and that sort of thing. Anyway, these agreements were made at world level, I refer to it as world level, and trickled down to the guys on the ground. The 11th Air Assault in the summer of 1965 became the 1st Air Cavalry Division, and they took all their helicopters, and they went to Vietnam, which left just the Army's Caribou aircraft at Fort Benning. And about that time, I was in Officer Candidate School, drawing towards the end where we got into our tactics. And instead of using helicopters for our air assault problem that we had, they stuck us in Caribous. And I thought that was kind of cool. So we droned around above Fort Benning for a while. And then I remember we went into a steep turn. We started to descend. And I looked out the little window behind me. And there was this little opening in the Fort Benning woods of the little dirt road in the middle of it. And I thought, no, he's not going to try to land there. And, well, he did. It turns out the Caribou is a short takeoff and landing aircraft and very good for operating out of tight places. Anyway, we landed, and in the cloud of dust and the roar of reversing propellers and so forth, the flight engineer lowered the ramp and said, get out of my airplane, and we all did. We ran up, you know, the infantry guys, we set up a perimeter of defense, and everybody's firing into the woods. We had flat attachments on our rifles that allowed us to shoot blanks. And I was so enthralled with this airplane and what it had done bringing us in here, I leaned up against a pine tree and turned around and watched it. I figured he was going to taxi back and then take off. Well, he didn't. He just stood on the brakes, run the engines up to full power, and released the brakes and took off. And I thought, he's not going to make it. He's going to hit those trees right to the end there. And he didn't. And I thought, I want to fly those things.
Now that was the beginning. Ray, we've got about 3 minutes before that we have to take a first break. So what you did end up flying is the O-1, correct? And tell us a little bit about that. I read a quote that said the O-1 was the slowest and deadliest aircraft in the U.S. inventory. But basically we're talking about a converted Cessna, right?
Actually, the Army and the Air Force let out a bid for contract for a light observation aircraft, and Cessna won the contract and designed this all-metal airplane with conventional landing gear, which means it has a tail wheel instead of a nose wheel. And they won the contract, and the Army fell in love with it and started using it. And it cruised at about 100 miles an hour. That was the normal speed that you flew over.
It's kind of hard for me to handle the word cruise when we're talking about an aircraft that's moving 100 miles an hour, but that's the point, I guess, huh? Yeah. Slow?
It's high wing, two seats in tandem. You could look out easily out either side of the aircraft. And the Army started using it as a visual reconnaissance platform, so you could fly around and look for stuff on the ground.
So single-engine aircraft, no armament other than you had the rockets that you could fire, and we'll talk a little bit more about that later. But so in the aircraft were two people next to each other, one in back.
One in back of the other.
Okay.
In tandem. There was no armament in the aircraft. When I got to Vietnam, our crew chiefs had wired a plate of metal underneath the pilot's seat, kind of in an angle. But the guys in the back seat, all they had between them and the outside world was some radios that wouldn't have stopped any bullet at all. A lot of them had put a little piece of flak vest back there or something to sit on, but still it wouldn't have stopped much.
Well, there's photos in your book, Cat Killer 3-2, of some of the rounds that your aircraft took. I guess at the end of the day, the fact that it was a very small, light aircraft with, I mean, a bullet would go through that,
oh, yeah,
that aluminum like butter, but that turned out to be a pretty good thing. You could fly looking like Swiss cheese if you had to, I suppose.
Yeah, some of the guys did come back looking like Swiss cheese from time to time. But yeah, it was a stout little airplane, all metal. Cessna did a heck of a job when they built that thing. The Marine Corps wound up flying some. The Air Force flew them for a while until they upgraded to a better airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And then the Army, that was the Army's visual reconnaissance platform.
So Ray Carroll ends up in Vietnam, and an officer gives you a choice of where you want to go. And oddly enough, you decided that you wanted to go to the most dangerous place because the guy up there owed you $40. Folks, this is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. We're joined by Ray Carroll. He's the author of Cat Killer 3-2. We're talking about the bird dog pilots in Vietnam. We'll be right back. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Buehler-Garcia. We're joined in studio by Ray Carroll. Ray is the author of Cat Killer 3-2, an Army pilot flying for the Marines in the Vietnam War. The book is fresh out on the shelves or Amazon or wherever you choose to shop. I personally recommend buying it from a local bookstore, but that's just me. It's a great read. I consider myself pretty well versed in military history and stories, but I learned a lot from this. Ray, we're talking about in the first segment that we referred to the spat between the Air Force and the Army on who gets to fly. One of the things I learned from your book is there was a similar sort of a debate on who and how would be allowed to call in air artillery strikes. You know, I learned from your book this was both a science and an art. And if I'm not mistaken, your unit was one of the very few that won that debate, correct?
Yes. I flew an I Corps, which was controlled by the Marines. 2, 3, and 4 Corps areas in Vietnam further south were all controlled by the Army. Now, of course, the Army had overall control of everything, but in the other three Corps areas, if you found a target and you were in supporting American troops on the ground, you basically had to call in your resident Air Force forward air controller to control the jets when they dropped their bombs and napalm. The Marines, the reason the 220th wound up in I Corps is because the Marines did not have enough bird dogs. And so as soon as the unit got to Vietnam thinking they were going to be in 3 Corps, they were told, no, you're going to I Corps and you're going to be working for the Marines. And so up they went. The Marines aerial observers were all well schooled and versed in all of the roles that we had to accomplish, adjusting artillery, naval gunfire, running the fixed wing jets, and they taught us how to do that. We'd been given some training in Army flight school in adjusting artillery. It wasn't very much. We did not receive any training at all in how to run the jets. And there's a nomenclature and a routine that you go through to do that correctly. So in I Corps, because the Marines controlled it, they said, we want our Army bird dog pilots to know how to do this. The Air Force was very reluctant to allow that to happen, but the Marines pushed hard, and they said, no, they're going to do it, and we're going to teach them how. And that's exactly what happened. So as Army pilots in I Corps flying for the 220th, we got to do stuff that the Army bird dog pilots in the Corps areas didn't. Some of our pilots even adjusted the gunfire of the battleship New Jersey into North Vietnam when they got up there with it. So, that kind of set us apart from other bird dog companies. Now, I understand that they were allowed to sort of control fixed wing if they had if they were supporting Arvin troops and an Arvin observer in the back seat. Of course, he'd be the one doing it because they were running the Vietnamese Air Force aircraft on the target. Or if they had a target that wasn't close to U.S. ground troops, the Army guys could kind of tell them where to drop and that sort of thing. But for us, for close air support, we were very unique in that role.
Ray, walk us through that, because one thing I learned from reading your book, I mean, I'm going through you guiding in, I think in this case it was some aircraft, some jet strikes, and I'm reading through your communication between yourself and the ground and the airplanes all at the same time, and your job was not only to protect the, in this case, the Marines or the soldiers on the ground, but you're also responsible for the safety of those other pilots that are coming in. Mm-hmm. And I mean, my brain literally started to lock up as I'm reading your book about everything that's going on. So I know there's no such thing as a normal mission, but in essence, Reader's Digest version, you're either up there on your own proactively, or you get a call from some Marines on the ground saying, hey, we need some help. You come in, you try and spot the target, mark it with white phosphorus, and then take us through what the next steps would be in this case with an incoming jet with some bombs on it.
Okay, he's going to – we would request the fixed wing, the jets through the desk, and they would control who we were going to get. If it was a hot target, and we'd get the A-4s. The A-4s are the best at close air support. They'd come up out of Chulai. And they always came in pairs. There was always two of them. And their basic load was 250-pound high-drag bombs, which were each one of them carried, I believe, six. And we called them snake eyes. Mm-hmm. And when they'd release that bomb, there's fins that pop out on the back, which would retard the descent of that bomb and give the jet that was dropping it enough time to get the heck out of the way before it hit the ground and blew up. That way they could drop as low as about 200 feet above the ground. They could release those bombs. They also carried 500-pound napalm under each wing. We typically try to get rid of the napalm first, and then that's pretty nasty stuff. And then they use the snake eyes. We had to know how close we could drop these things to the friendlies. The marking the target with a white phosphorus rocket was key to the whole thing, and we were pretty accurate with that thing.
Well, and really for our civilian listeners too, it's not just where they drop it. Like in the case of napalm, where it's going to hit the ground and spread and splatter. So it's not just where, but also the direction of approach and the direction of which the ordnance impacts. Correct?
Yeah, you try not to get when you get the jets on station and you put your smoke down, and you'd use a clock system. If your smoke hit in a certain spot and you really wanted that bomb to be 200 meters before that smoke on his run-in heading, well, you tell him, from my smoke, 6 o'clock, 200 meters. So it was like the clock system, 1 mm-hmm. o'clock, 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock, so on and so forth. And that's what got him going the right direction. And then you'd have to clear him hot for each run. You'd give him his run-in heading. You'd give him the location of the nearest friendlies. You'd give him the information of if you were being shot at, possibly what caliber it was. If it was a heavy machine gun, they'd like to know that. You'd also tell him which direction to turn after he's dropped. You always try to turn to get him away from any possible hostile ground fire. And you'd also tell him where you were going to be. And I tell him, I'll be orbiting over the top of the troops at 800 feet or something like that. And so he'd know where you were.
How did you know what caliber from the sound? Or?
Well, AK-47s, you couldn't even see those things. But mm-hmm. if they start shooting at you with the 12.7 machine guns, which is like a 50 caliber machine gun, you could see those tracers. They were green.
Okay.
And anything heavier than that, then there'd be big explosions in the sky. So the 12.7s were pretty nasty stuff. I didn't encounter them very often. And you just run the first guy in, and then from his drop, you tell Dash 2 from Dash 1's drop, 9 o'clock, 50 meters. And you tell him if you want him to drop singles or pairs. And you just control them that way. But you had to turn and see him. And typically you'd see the glint of their wings as they turn from base to final and their final approach in there. And if he was lined up and he looked like he was lined up correctly the way you wanted him, then you'd clear him hot. If he wasn't for some reason, you'd call him off and tell him to go high and dry, and we'd do it all again until we got it right.
Ray, I half expected when I was looking at some of the photos in your book here to see a guy with six arms. I mean, you're flying the aircraft, pedals, rudder, stick, carburetor, throttle, and then you've got all these radios going on. I mean, the frequency to the other aircraft, the frequency to the troops on the ground, you're talking on the intercom. And we've got about a couple of minutes. When we come back, I want to tell you a story about how important that was. You were out flying around over Vietnam enjoying your day when all of a sudden this steel rain starts dropping from the sky, and Ray Carroll learned a lesson that day about not to turn off the UHF frequency, I guess.
Yes, huh? I did.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined in studio by Ray Carroll. He's the author of Cat Killer 3-2, an Army pilot flying for the Marines in the Vietnam War. Hey, listen, you can find this podcast and others, AmericanWarriorRadio.com, on Facebook, American Warrior Radio. We even have a Twitter page at Warrior Radio TUC. Stick around. We'll be right back. Back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. Our guest is Ray Carroll, author of Cat Killer 3-2. Ray, I apologize for playing a Navy song for an Army guy, but it's all good, right?
No, I supported the Marines, and Marines
there you go.
Part of the Navy. So,
Ray, we were talking about just sort of the confusion that as a civilian, it struck me as confusion, but a lot of stuff going on in the cockpit when you're up there supporting the Marines or the soldiers on the ground, calling in air support. One of the stories that, again, things that we don't think about, but you're flying at a few hundred feet maybe initially, and there's lots of other stuff going on in the air and the ground, and you relate a story where you were flying nice sunny day over Vietnam, and all of a sudden you start to see these puffs of smoke come up on the ground, and you're thinking, holy cow, I've got a problem.
Explosions, yeah. We've been, let me back up a little bit. We have one UHF, ultra-high frequency radio, and to transmit on. That's what we normally talk to the jets with. Then we had two FM radios. One, we could talk on one of them at a time, but we could receive both of them at the same time. Plus, my observer and I were always talking to each other on intercom. So we became a team. Very quickly, as a new pilot, you were integrated into the system, and you learned very quickly that you were a team, and pretty soon we even knew what each other was thinking. So there was a flow of communication between the two of us that was very helpful. At any given time, one of us might be controlling the fixed wing. The other one might be talking to the ground and controlling artillery, because before you'd run the fixed wing, you'd have to shut off the artillery so they didn't get hit. And surprisingly, it flowed very, very smoothly and very easily. Well, on a particular day up on the DMZ, the DMZ marked the separation between North and South Vietnam, and half of my tour was up there. We'd been working with a company of Marines, and in the middle of working with them, the Air Force was performing a rescue in Laos, and, of course, radios being line of sight, we were hearing the whole thing on guard. So I reached up and I flipped the switch from transmit, receive, plus guard to just transmit and receive. Thus, we didn't have to, we weren't being interfered with the all that was going on in that rescue. I forgot to turn the switch back so that it also be monitoring guard. Well, there's a facility there out of Da Nang, call sign Panama, and they would give what they called a heavy artillery warning anytime there was going to be a B-52 strike. And they'd tell us basically where it was going to be, and this was usually 10, 15 minutes before it was going to happen. And they always transmitted that information on guard. Well, I had guard off, and so we didn't get the message. And we were droning along there, and all of a sudden I see this bunch of explosions moving towards us on the ground, and we very quickly realized that it wasn't artillery, and if anybody was shooting anything up there, it should have been us. I realized very quickly it was a B-52 strike. At the time, I did not realize that they flew in cells of three. Mm-hmm. And so I turned to the right, thinking I'd just fly south and get out of the line of it. And there's another line of explosions parallel to the first line. And I thought, oh, no, I'm going to fly through those. So I went back 180 degrees the other way, and then here I saw the third line of explosions. So all I could do was just start climbing. I put the coals to it, poured power on, and told my observer. By then, he's yelling at me, what the heck's going on? And I said, well, there's a B-52 strike, and we're in the middle of it. And he says, well, I'll pray for us, but when we get on the ground, I'll probably kick your backside. He didn't.
Well, you know, I love the stories in your book, not just because, and there's some very serious messages in there as well, but the other story I really enjoyed, sometimes things might, I don't want to say got boring up there, but you tell a story about it's almost like something out of an old black and white movie where our Vietnamese allies are on one end of the bridge and the Marines on the other, and nobody, you know, somebody's got to cross and nobody's given any ground. Well, apparently there's another allied Vietnamese bird dog in the air, and so you decided just to liven things up. You'd get on his tail and do a little fighter pilot stuff. That was didn't quite turn out the way you had hoped, though, huh? Tell us about that, Ray.
Well, I was doing convoy cover that day, and convoy cover was usually pretty boring. I was droning along, listening to Armed Forces radio and trying to sing along. We got to a bridge, and my Marine Corps convoy was already partially across the bridge when a Vietnamese Army of Vietnam convoy coming south. Anyway, they locked horns there in the middle, and neither one of them would back up. And then I noticed a VNAF, Vietnamese Air Force bird dog. He showed up, and he's circling over the top of this mess. And the secret behind convoy movement is movement. And my convoy wasn't moving, and that makes them a real ripe target. So I was concerned about that. And then I saw this other bird dog, and I thought, well, maybe if I jump this guy and harass him a little bit, he'll talk to his people on the ground and tell them, let the Marines through and just get on with the day. So I kept maneuvering around and wound up behind him. I discovered that I could, if I lowered a little bit of flaps, I could turn inside of his turns. He tried his best to evade me, but he couldn't. And for a military pilot, if you can jump him and stay on his tail, that's kind of a serious gotcha. Mm-hmm. So I figured I'd really, really accomplish something there. I was busy putting a trophy up on my mantelpiece. And he flew off. And out of nowhere came two VNAF A1E Sky Raiders, wingtip to wingtip, right at me. And they pulled up just within... They couldn't have been more than 300 feet away from me when they pulled up. It was vapor coming off their wingtips. I learned a lesson that day. Our convoy got through just fine, but I learned that I shouldn't be jumping VNAF bird dog pilots because they have friends out there that I don't know about.
So what was the scoreboard that day, right?
Well, the scoreboard was, let's see. Marine Corps convoy won, VNAF bird dog pilot won, and I got zero.
Ray got blanked. There's just too many stories to tell that we have time for, Ray. I encourage people, again, to get their own copy. The book is called Cat Killer 3-2, An Army Pilot Flying for the Marines in Vietnam War. The Tet Offensive, you dedicate a chapter to that. You literally were in the I don't think you had an officer's club, but you're in the bunker enjoying a nice whiskey, and when this whole thing kicked off, and that really compelling stories about you and your fellow pilots. I mean, to me, just the heroism of, I mean, first thing you do is run out to get in your plane to go up and see what you can do to help.
We were in the Black Cat Officers Club. We were co-located at Marble Mountain Airfield with an Army helicopter company that supported the Vietnamese Marines. Vietnamese Marines. Anyway, I was in the club. The bartender just slid my fourth double scotch and water in front of me, and all hell broke loose. And they were shooting, and so everybody vacated the club. I, of course, took my drink out with me. And somebody's yelling, get in the bunkers, get in the bunkers. I don't like bunkers. I didn't feel at all safe in one. So I just kept my drink in my hand, went up and got my flight gear and everything. And one of our crew chiefs.
Let me interrupt you there for a second, because a key phrase there, I kept my drink in my hand.
Yeah.
Well, okay.
Yeah.
Just
well,
checking.
It was scotch.
Okay.
Know. And one of our crew chiefs, and those guys are the unsung heroes of the unit, believe me, was getting one of the bird dogs ready to go. And he asked me, he said, do you want this one? I said, you bet I do. I don't want to be on the ground. So about that time, a Marine AO, aerial observer, showed up. And he said, do you want to fly? And I said, I sure do. So he got in, and I finished my pre-flight, got in, and put my little glass of scotch there between my legs and fired that bird dog up and took off. We wound up flying all night long, coming in a couple of times to refuel. And somewhere in the middle of all that, I tossed the empty glass out. I probably shouldn't have been, well, by Army regulations, I should not have been flying. But I think there was probably so much adrenaline running through me. That was the night Tet started in 68, mm-hmm. and there was a lot of bullets flying around out there. So I just felt better in the sky.
Well, and as I understand, the story goes, and when you landed after that, I don't know if it was to refuel or what, but another pilot basically came up and said, okay, it's my turn. And now, was he a superior officer?
He was a captain. I was okay. The first lieutenant, and he was my brand-new platoon leader. And he came out and announced very loudly that he was going to take my airplane. And I said, you get your own airplane, Captain. Mm-hmm. And my observer and I took off again. And that's when we had our fun with Spooky and with Guns of Go-Go.
Well, and there again, those two stories are pretty important. And folks are going to have to get the book to read about that. Real quick, Ray, before we take the next break, you saved a lot of lives. But I'm guessing there was also some points where you're flying 100 feet, 50 feet, 1,000 feet above the ground. Were there times where you just you felt kind of helpless because there was just, I mean, war is a terrible thing and you can't always help.
Yeah, I had more than one occasion that the worst one was probably the night in Operation Swift in Quezon Valley where we really couldn't help anybody. But
mm-hmm.
that's in the book.
Okay.
Our mission was to do everything we could for the Marine Corps grunts on the ground, and anything we could do for them to help them and support them was that was our mission. That's what we did, and we loved doing it.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're joined in studio by Ray Carroll. He's the author of Cat Killer 3-2, a very compelling book. I encourage you to get a copy of it and read it. We got one more segment when we come back. Stick around. Welcome back to American Warrior Radio, ladies and gentlemen. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking about the bird dog pilots in Vietnam and one particular group, the cat killers, as they were appropriately named. Well, I don't want to say appropriately named, but again, I don't want to offend. I'm a cat guy. I love cats, but this was not that. Read the book. Our guest is Ray Carroll. He's the author of Cat Killer 3-2, an Army pilot flying for the Marines in the Vietnam War. Ray, before we took the last break, we talked about some situations where you might have found yourself feeling a little bit helpless, but at the same time, there was also some amazing examples of compassion and things that you witnessed or were part of. In one case, there was an incident where the Marines were taking fire from a village. You called in airstrikes on the village, pretty much took care of all the bad guys, but then before they would move in, they were asking for you to double check. They weren't going to move into that village so they knew that it was all secure. And what you witnessed then is a really heartwarming story, and you said that's burned in your mind forever.
Yeah, the commander of the unit was reluctant to move in towards the village, and we had spotted what looked like a woman. Vietnamese woman carrying a baby in her arms, and she was moving out of the village towards where the Marines were. And we called the guys on the ground and said, hey, can you send a medic or something out there? It looks like she's wounded. And the CO of the unit said, no, we were just taking ground fire out of there 30 minutes ago. We're not going to do that. So I talked it over quickly with my observer, and I said, why don't we just go down and troll? If anybody's still in there and they're angry and they want to shoot, they'll probably shoot at us. And so we did. We circled the village. I slowed it way down, and we circled the village at about 100 feet. Went around two times and convinced the commander of the Marine Corps company that nobody was in there going to shoot at him. And so as we circled the village the third time and came around, there was a sight that will forever be burned in my memory. There were two young Marines and a Navy corpsman out there. On the paddy dike, the Navy corpsman was busy bandaging the woman's leg, and one of the Marines was standing there with his rifle up, and he was facing the village. The other one had this infant, this baby, Vietnamese babies didn't wear diapers. So he had this little bare-bottom baby on his left hip holding him there, probably maybe a year, a little bit more than that old. And in his other hand, he had his M16 rifle. And I thought, boy, that, if that isn't a spectacle of what American soldiers and Marines and special ops guys have been doing for 200 years, protecting people that can't protect themselves. And that just shows you that, you know, how good we are when we really get out there and try to do something. Guys are willing to risk their lives to protect people that can't protect themselves.
I'm glad you brought that up, because that's really sort of the heart of one of the messages we want to communicate here on American Warrior Radio. Ray, I mentioned at the top of the show that you were very excited when you got to Vietnam because they issued you one of the new not M16 but the Car 15. So that was kind of a cool. But generally, you're up there with not much to protect yourself. Correct me if I don't know if I read this right, but I got the author here, so let me benefit from his knowledge and wisdom. There was a case where a Vietnamese soldier actually surrendered to you flying an airplane, right?
Yeah.
That didn't happen very often.
Rob Whitlow, he was my AO that day. Rob and I are still buddies. There's another little story in there in that book about Rob and myself. We were out, and he'd made contact with one of the companies on the ground, and they said, well, we've been getting sniped at. We've actually got a wounded guy down here, and would you kind of cruise around and see if you can figure out where these people are that are shooting at us? And just by chance, out of the corner of my eye, I saw in a big clump of trees a couple hundred meters to the east of where this Marines were, a big white bird, like a crane or something, was spooked. It flew out of this clump of trees, and I saw a leg disappear into it. And I thought, well, that's
a human leg.
Yeah, a human leg. Okay,
yeah.
Thought that's where they are. So we told the guys on the ground, and they had a little 60-millimeter mortar, and they popped a few rounds in those trees, and sure enough, two guys with guns came running out of there and running down the paddy dike. Well, they opened fire on them, and they winged one of them, and he was flopping around on the ground. The other one just kept running. By then, he'd thrown away his rifle, too. And so I told the guys on the ground that we'll go harass this guy and try to keep him slowed down so he can't get away from you. If you can get a couple of your Marines to drop their packs and take off after this guy, maybe they can capture him too, which we did. And I kept making low passes at this guy, and he'd very low passes, as a matter of fact. He'd throw himself on the ground, and I'd miss him, and then I'd climb back up to 100 feet or so and circle back around, and he'd run, and then I'd make a low pass, and he'd hit the ground. And this went on for a little while, and finally, and he was pretty tired.
Mm-hmm.
There was a dry paddy dike there, and he just got out in the middle of a dry paddy dike and stood there and held his arms up over his head. And I was circling him about 100 feet or so, just going in circles around him. He actually surrendered to us until the Marines caught up with him, and then we left.
Well, and just to give listeners a perspective, for Tucson listeners, if you're in Tucson at night and you see the police helicopter flying over Tucson, they're generally at about 500 feet. So you're flying a fixed-wing aircraft 100 miles an hour at 50 feet. That's pretty darn close to the ground.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's fun.
You know, Ray, I'm always amazed when I speak to heroes like yourself and others about really what a small world it is. And there was an incident you were involved in, probably one of the hairier incidents of your time flying there in Vietnam, where a helicopter exploded and took off some of your landing gear, and you had to land the plane and were sort of dressed down by the helicopter squadron commander. But you didn't really know what happened, but what, 30 years later, you run into a fellow when you're flying in the National Guard, and he had the answer for, or at least a answer for you, huh?
Yeah, it was there were two H-13 helicopters. That's, if you folks remember the movie MASH, That was an H-13 helicopter that they show in that movie MASH. And there were two of them that were flying near me, and one of them apparently blew up and slung something, tore one of the landing gear completely out of my airplane, and I had to crash land it back at Dong Ha. That's another story. But years later, I'm at Fort Rucker, Alabama, going through the Apache helicopter transition, and there was an Army colonel there, and full colonel, going through the same thing. And he had a first cav patch on his right shoulder, which meant that he served with the first cav in combat. So I approached him and talked to him and asked him when he'd been there, and he said 1968. And I said, did you happen to be in the 1st or the 9th Cavalry? Because that's who was up there at Dong Ha at the time. He said, yeah. And so I told him about this incident that happened. This helicopter blew up, slung something, and I crash-landed. He said, yeah. He says, I remember that, which I thought was unusual. But he said, yeah, I remember that. I said, well, it's haunted me all these years. Why did that helicopter just blow up in midair? And he said, well, they figured they never were able to really come to an absolute certain conclusion, but they figured that because they carried smoke grenades in a little wooden box between the two guys in the helicopter, and normally they had smoke grenades in there that they'd mark a target with or something, and they felt that maybe these guys had a white phosphorus grenade in there, mm-hmm. and they straighten all the pins on the grenade so they're easier to pull, and they think that maybe one of the pins vibrated out and the thing went off, and of course the helicopter and the two guys were in it basically got vaporized. Sad, but yeah. On the other hand, it's war. Accidents happen and
people die. Well, Ray Carroll survived. You came home and went on to several other careers. I want to talk to you about one of which. When you were flying a lead plane for the U.S. Forest Service. Ray, I never served. I guess the closest, when I talk about this, the closest I've ever come to that. I mean, I fought forest fires to pay for college when I was going to school. And there was one area up in the White Mountains, Greer, where normally we'd have to stay in our response area until we were dispatched to a fire. But if anything popped in Greer because of all the expensive homes and, the senators and the governor had homes there, everybody rolled on that. So we roll out to a fire in Greer on my tanker, and we're fighting this fire on the side of a hill. And for those folks who don't understand, when the slurry planes come in, there's usually a lead plane that comes in first to check the winds and do some other stuff before they make the drop. And we're on this fire, Ray, and a lead plane flies over us, and we didn't call for slurry. And we're thinking, what? We had just enough time to say, what the heck? And then, the lead plane comes over again. I was like, oh, and we just had enough time to jump under our tanker before they, well, it turns out there was a fire on the other ridge that had called for the slurry, not us. And, when that stuff hits the ground, you've been in the air. I don't know if you've been on the ground, but when that stuff comes down, it will snap trees. And that was a pretty, pretty hairy situation. So I'm glad it wasn't you. You weren't in the area at the time.
Water is 8.34 pounds per gallon. That retardant is 9.5 pounds a gallon. And if you get hit with a ball of that stuff, it probably knock you down. It'll sure turn you pink, that's for sure.
Well, yeah, almost like those pink elephants you saw in Vietnam. Yeah. But again, that's another story. Folks need to read the book. Ray, I read something that you mentioned, that you wouldn't trade that experience in Vietnam for $1 million.
I wouldn't.
That's not something you hear very often from a Vietnam veteran.
The role that we played was directly supporting the troops on the ground. That's what made it important to me. That's what we live for. That every day, that's what we did, and it just had a lot of meaning to it. It's like if you're a firefighter or any first responder, there's a sense of accomplishment that goes along with that. It's hard to define, but it has a lot of meaning to you, and you live with that deep in your heart. I don't know what else to say about that, really.
Well, thank you so much for your service and for this great book. Again, folks, you can get a copy of it. It's called Cat Killer 3-2, An Army Pilot Flying for the Marines in the Vietnam War. Any parting thoughts for us, Ray?
Well, just one. For any young listeners out there, don't reject serving in the U.S. military as a stepping stone to lifelong success and satisfaction. There's a lot there to be gained, so if you're curious about what you want to do the rest of your life, go check it out. It sure helped me. It gave me a lifelong career, and I met a lot of really good people.
Well, Ray, thank you so much for your time here on American Warrior Radio. Folks, that's another one. We're glad to have you tune in with us here. You can find this podcast and others, AmericanWarriorRadio.com. Check us out on Facebook, American Warrior Radio. We even have a Twitter page, at Warrior Radio TUC. Hey, listen, if you support what we're doing, you can, you know, for the price of less than one cup of coffee a month, you can support American Warrior's radio mission to expand this to other listeners. Go to Patreon.com, Patreon.com/AmericanWarriorRadio. You can support us there by contributing to the program, get some really cool swag as well as part of that. And, hey, if you have other ideas for guests, we're all about the men and women in the military and our first responders. Send us those ideas as well. We'd love to get them on the show whenever we get a chance. Ray, thanks again for appearing on American Warrior Radio. The book is Cat Killers 3-2, An Army Pilot Flying for the Marines in the Vietnam War. Until next time, all policies and procedures remain in place.
You can hear over 150 episodes of this program at AmericanWarriorRadio.com.